2016, Otsuka America Pharmaceutical, Inc. v. Hedera Labs, Ltd. Okay, Mr. Samuel.
Ready? May it please the Court. My name is Ehab Samuel on behalf of Appellants Hedera Labs, Hedera Labs Unit 3, and Canberra Pharmaceuticals. Oh, sorry, the time hasn't started. The time hasn't started.
It'll get fixed. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. We've reserved 4 minutes for rebuttal. This appeal arises from a preliminary injunction improperly enjoining appellants from launching their generic drug. The central issue is claim construction. The claim is directed to a method of treating a neurological disorder. It requires two compounds, dextromethorphan and quinidine, to be administered in a specified weight-to-weight ratio of 1 to 0.5 or less. The question is, Your Honor, how to calculate that ratio? Our construction is simple. The ratio is compares the weight of dextromethorphan to the weight of quinidine as compounds, not the weight of their salts.
How do you know that from the specification?
So the specification teaches us two instances. First, the specification talks about how...
How do you know that from the claim also?
Okay.
I mean, my question is, I mean, it doesn't say, you know, the effective dosage, the effective ratio, and the specification uses... It has some language in it that suggests that when it uses those terms, that it's referring to the salt forms as well.
Okay, so let's start with the claims, Your Honor. The claims actually support our construction, and the claims recite dextromethorphan and quinidine as in a specified weight-to-weight ratio. This claim is agnostic as to delivery form and imposes no limitation as to the form of delivery. And when the inventors intended to claim salts, they did so specify clearly in the dependent claims themselves.
Why wouldn't I understand that to mean that it's including, that these phrases, dextromethorphan and quinidine, includes the salt forms when the dependent claims refer to the salt forms?
So that's going into the specification now, Your Honor. Do you want to finish off on the claims, or should we jump into the specifications?
No, I was talking about the dependent claims.
The dependent claims are not saying they include... The dependent claims are not saying dextromethorphan includes dextromethorphan hydrobromide. They're saying the claim that they are administered in a pharmaceutically acceptable salt. That's not an invitation or an authorization to change the meaning of dextromethorphan and quinidine in the claimed ratio itself. Claim one is agnostic as to the delivery form itself, and that doesn't change irrespective of, and it doesn't matter what the type of delivery form itself.
But if you're saying that claim one is agnostic, that sounds like you're saying that claim one includes the salt forms as well as the freebase form of dextromethorphan and quinidine, correct?
Yes, it does include any kind of form.
But
however, Your Honor,
the ratio requires you to limit yourself to the active ingredient.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Which means that you're reading the term dextromethorphan at the beginning of Claim 1, for example, in a way that sounds like it's inconsistent with the meaning of the term at the end of the claim where you get to the ratio.
No, Your Honor.
But you just told me, I think, a moment ago that in Claim 1, dextromethorphan includes the salt forms.
No, that's not what I meant.
Okay. I thought that's what you said.
The Claim 1 includes all kinds of forms. However, the
including salts.
If I may. The dextromethorphan term in Claim 1, whether it's used in the range or whether it's used in the range ratio, we're referring to the compounds. However, the claim itself can be administered in any kind of form. So the ratio itself, and that goes to the, now we can go to the specification.
So by including it in salt, using a salt carrier doesn't exclude it from the coverage of the claim, but the reference is still to the active ingredient.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's what the specification teaches. The specification, in fact, talks about how dextromethorphan and quinidine They're well-known compounds. In fact, APPX 55 shows a picture of dextromethorphan. APPX 57 shows a picture of quinidine. These are well-known compounds. They were known by name and structure. And the patent explains quinidine's purpose and the purpose of this invention. It's to increase the dextromethorphan blood level and to yield more consistent and predictable results of dextromethorphan in that blood, in the blood.
In several places in your patent, in your briefing, you say the patent makes clear that the ratio in the claim is referring to what I'm going to say is the base form ratio. Does that make sense to you? In other words, that it's the non-salt form for the ratio.
Yes, and you it's called
cite
pre-base.
Column 17 through column 18 for that position. I think you know where I'm referring to. I'm having a hard time seeing it as somebody who maybe doesn't have the technical background. And let me tell you some of the reasons why. And I just want to see what your response is. I mean, in this, it's giving amounts both for the salt form and then for the free base form. And it talks about an effective dosage when it's talking about the free base form. But the claim doesn't say anything about an effective dosage. I mean, couldn't you have said effective dosage if that's what you meant?
Well, that's Otsuka's argument, but it's a misplaced argument, Your Honor, because that's essentially trying to suggest that the word dextromethorphan has different meaning otherwise. This is the plain and ordinary meaning of dextromethorphan, is the well-known compounds shown in the specifications. Nothing in the intrinsic record that suggests omitting that phrase converts that claim ratio into a salt-based measurement. And, Your Honors, if we go to...
Well, it wouldn't make any sense, would it? Because the salt isn't... it's not therapeutic. It's just a carrier for the active ingredient.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's
and
the whole point.
If you look at the prosecution history, distinguishing the Smith patent, there's some fine lines being drawn here between 1 to 0.5 and 1 point, and 1 to 0.75 and saying, no, this wasn't anticipated by the Smith patent, which has the same specification, because we're using a different amount of active ratio of active ingredients.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Can I go back to my questions about columns 17 and 18? When I look at the amounts, there's a couple examples that show that the salt forms result in, I think, the proper ratio, but the corresponding effective dosage forms do not have the correct ratio in the claim, or they don't have the ratio in the claim. I'll give you, like, for example, in column 18, line 6, it says 60 milligrams of dextromethorphan hydrobromide and 30 quinidine sulfate. So that would be falling within the ratio of the claim. But when I look at what none of the corresponding effective dosages fall within the ratio of the claim. So I am having a hard time seeing why I should read the claim in light of the specification to require that it be effective dosage as opposed to salt form dosage.
So there's 2 points on that issue. Point number one is if you look anywhere in the specification, you're not going to find the claimed ranges and the claimed ratio disclosed in the specification. You really kind of figured that out later after the
fact.
Well,
that's assuming that the claimed dosage and ratio
regardless
is
of whether
not
it's assuming
form,
or,
right?
Regardless of whether it's referred to as effective dose or not. It's just not disclosed in there.
It's a range in the claim. Right?
But it's not in the specification.
Okay.
The second point as to determining that ratio, and that because that's where the patent teaches that when you use that salt, you convert. That's a really critical point that really Otsuka doesn't reconcile with that issue. Why would you even disclose this if you're not going to convert? If your ratio is based on salt form, what's the purpose of this language? Why is it being used? What does it serve? It doesn't answer that question. But the way to convert, if for example, a good example is the 30 milligrams of dextromethorphan hydrobromide converts to 22 milligrams. It's roughly 83%. converts to 22 milligrams of dextromethorphan. And that's what a person would use in that ratio. Why? Because that's how you can get the consistent and predictable blood levels of dextromethorphan in the blood. It's what you know, that's how you know what you're putting into the human body. It's not some salt form in which some salts might have a higher weight and you don't have as much dextromethorphan. And so that's what it's important. And so going into the prosecution history, Judge Dyke, you were right. The examiner understood the inventor's intention here, the intent here. And that's to, the examiner mapped the compound-based ratio. It's a compound-based prior art reference, Smith. There was no discussion at all or a disclosure of a pharmaceutically acceptable salt. And when salt was at issue...
The discovery here was that the amount of quinidine in the ratio, right? By reducing, the idea was that you could reduce the amount of quinidine in the ratio from Smith patent that was 0.75 or whatever it was to 0.50, right?
Correct.
The whole focus was on the amount of active ingredient.
Correct, Your Honor. And you can see that conversion play out also in the original claims that were filed. Original claim one, the claims were originally filed show the intention of the use of the term dextromethorphan to mean the compounds. Original claim one capped quinidine at 50 milligrams, while original dependent claim nine capped it at 60 milligrams. Now, you can't have a dependent that has a weight range greater than the independent. That would improperly expand, not narrow, the scope of the dependent claim. So the only way those claims can be reconciled is if quinidine sulfate, the weight of that quinidine sulfate, is converted using that conversion table to quinidine and to determine the equivalent amount.
You're talking about canceled claim 9?
Correct, Your Honor.
Which doesn't appear in the current patent.
Correct, but it still shows the intent of the inventors, and the inventors haven't changed that in any way throughout the prosecution history, that intent. I would just like to jump to, Your Honors, the reasons for why Otsuka's construction is wrong. Otsuka's construction wants you to look to the infringing product. That's what they're saying as the metric to determine the claim scope. Claims, as Judge Stoll, you mentioned in the first hearing, you know, that's not how you determine claim scope by the accused product. Second point is Otsuka misapplies the doctrine of claim differentiation. The focus of the claim is not on the delivery form. It's on the compound ratio, and it does not matter the delivery form. Claim one is agnostic, and the claim structure itself does not redefine the meaning of dextromethorphan and quinidine. Finally, I want to point to, Your Honors, the fact that if we are to construe the same way that Otsuka's construction based on salt base, that would render the claim indefinite. In fact, the district court made no findings on indefiniteness, and had it made a finding on indefiniteness, it would have realized that if you apply the salt, if you apply that ratio, it would mean it could be the compound or the salt. And that would yield materially different results with different outcomes, no metric whatsoever for a person skilled in the art to determine what's the scope of the patents. In fact, that falls squarely in the four corners of Teva versus Sandoz, where we had the claims were deemed indefinite because the term molecular weight could be calculated in three different ways, each yielding three different results, and the patent did not specify which one to use.
Now, would you agree that where the patent specification uses the word DM, the abbreviation DM, and the abbreviation Q, that refers to either DM, dextromethorphan, or in the case of quinidine, or their salts?
Regardless of how it's being used, Your Honor, for purposes of the ratio, it's still going to have to be the weight of the compounds.
The patent is, I think you will agree with me, often uses DM and Q not to be limited just to the dextromethorphan.
So in some instances, Your Honor, there may be some shorthand as trying to refer to the product that's being used, that's being administered. That being said, when it came down to the application of that ratio, the intent of the inventors was clear, whether it's in the original claims, whether it's the, in response to the examiner, it's the ratio is based on the compounds, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve a few more minutes left.
Well, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Scott.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Appellant,
so I'm having trouble understanding how your claim construction makes any sense in terms of this patent. You've got these two active ingredients. You had a earlier Smith patent, which covered various ratios of the active ingredients. And you, in the prosecution history, you distinguished this ratio as being different and providing benefits because of the lower amount of quinidine. The whole focus is on the active ingredient. Why in heaven's name would it make sense to measure the ratio in terms of the product with the salt carrier, which is not an active ingredient?
Your Honor, the claims are focused on the administration and focused on what is being administered. And the word administered is used 3 times in Claim 1.
I don't think you're responding to my point. The concern here is with the amount of active ingredient, not with whether it includes a salt form or not. And why does it make any sense to say that once it's administered in a salt form, that the ratio of active ingredient is somehow thrown out the window?
The patent is not about blood levels. The claims are not about blood levels. The claims are focused on what is actually being administered to the patient, what is being put into the patient's mouth. That's the whole focus here. Yes, there is disclosure and discussion of blood levels, but there is no mention of them. Blood levels of AUC.
What
of
was
CMAX.
The invention here? What was the 1:0.5 ratio? What was the invention? The invention was that you go have a lower dose of quinidine, which was beneficial, right?
The original work by Smith used 150 milligrams of quinidine.
No, you're not answering my question. This patent that we're talking about here, the invention was being able to reduce the quinidine so that it's 1:0.5 of quinidine, right? And that was thought to have beneficial effects.
That it was surprising that a much lower, sub-maximally inhibiting dose of quinidine could still allow for the treatment of pseudobulbar.
Right, and so why does it make any sense to say that the ratio varies depending on whether it's administered in salt form or a base form?
That is what the claim requires. The claim is discussing what is being administered to the patient, and that is the way that construction is.
So the amount of active ingredient varies under the claim depending on whether it's administered in a salt form or a base form.
The active ingredient is the dextromethorphan hydrobromide or the dextromethorphan quinidine. If you look to the label that Hetero submitted to the FDA, it states explicitly that the active ingredient is 20 milligrams dextromethorphan hydrobromide and 10 milligrams quinidine sulfate. So here the focus is on what is being administered.
You mentioned the labeling, but in FDA labeling under the FDA salt policy, you describe the active ingredient, right? That's the way the labels are done. Are you familiar with the salt?
I was answering your question, Your Honor. You asked me what the active ingredient is.
Well, you talked about the labeling. I'm saying to you that FDA labeling requires that you specify the active ingredient, even if it's measured as, even if it's administered together with salt.
So that is what Hetero's label discloses to the world that is being administered in each pill.
Is that in the appendix? Do you want to turn to
that? Yes, Your Honor. That is
maybe page 1374.
13 of our of the red brief. It is on page 12 of the red brief. It's APPX 481. That states that it contains dextromethorphan hydrobromide 20 milligrams and quinidine sulfate 10 milligrams. So to describe
which page of the red brief is labeled here?
Page 12.
This is this one. That was the quotation from the label in the description of the label at APPX 494. It goes on to say,
you're looking at 481 and 494?
And 494, under the description, section 11 of the label, dextromethorphan hydrobromide is the pharmaceutically active ingredient of dextromethorphan hydrobromide and quinidine sulfate capsules. But with respect to Your Honor's initial question about how it could contain, how Claim 1 could be focused on the salt, it based on the principles of claim differentiation, it has to. If you go down to Dependent Claim 9, for example.
Under your construction, if it's administered in the base form, there's one ratio of the active ingredient. If it's administered in the salt form, there's a different ratio.
Someone were to choose to administer, to actually administer in a free base form, you would use the amount of free base form. If one were to choose administer...
So that the ratio of active ingredient varies under the claim depending on whether it's administered in the free base form or salt.
Those would be different products, but yes, if you administered a different product, you would have a different calculation.
How does that make any sense?
They're different products, Your Honor. You look to what is actually being administered. The focus remains on the material that is being put into the pill. If Hetero were to put a different material into its pill, there could be a different calculation. But what they put into their pill was 10 milligrams dextromethorphan hydrobromide and 10 milligrams quinidine sulfate. So there's no issue of ambiguity in the claim. The claim is focused on the material being administered. If you go down to Dependent Claim 9,
isn't it equally consistent with the language that it's referring to the active ingredient?
What language are you referring to, Your Honor?
The language of the claim.
The language of the claim states that the amount of dextromethorphan administered comprises 20 milligrams to 80 milligrams per day, and the amount of quinidine administered comprises 10 to less than 30.
Why isn't that saying you calculate the amount of the active ingredient administered, whether it's the free base form or the salt form, and it's the same amount of active ingredient in each case?
No, Your Honor. This is saying that you use the amount of what's actually being administered. The keyword here is administered in comparison to the language that's used in the specification describing the calculation, a corresponding effective dose. Does not say corresponding effective dose, it says administered. And if you go down to Claim 9, the method of Claim 1, wherein about 20 milligrams quinidine sulfate is administered, the 20 milligrams quinidine sulfate, the antecedent basis for the quinidine sulfate is the quinidine in Claim 1. And in the portion of the specification that I believe my friend was referring to, which is...
Did you agree that administering it with a salt doesn't change the therapy, that the active ingredient is the same amount, whether it's administered in a salt form or a free base form?
If you're going to... Are you asking about what corresponding
the
levels would exist?
The therapeutic effect is the same whether you administer a particular quantity in free base form or you administer that same quantity together with a salt.
I believe the therapeutic efficacy here is determined based upon the dose being administered. That was one of the main focus of the district court finding below.
My question is, the therapeutic effect is the same whether you administer it in free base form or together with a salt, correct?
I believe what you're saying is accurate.
If you have 10 milligrams of quinidine administered in freebase form or 10 milligrams administered together with a salt, the therapeutic effect of those two is the same, right?
If you're talking about blood levels, Your Honor, I believe they would produce the same blood levels. But that is not what the claim is referring to. This is a claim about what is being administered to the patient. And the specification, the claims, the specification of the prosecution history confirm that. And we have not seen any lexicography or clear and unambiguous disavowal that would exclude salts from the words dextromethorphan and quinidine in Claim 1. In fact, the other claims necessarily the words dextromethorphan and quinidine in Claim 1 necessarily are broad enough to include salts based on the dependent claims and the specification, which states that for each embodiment, the quinidine includes quinidine sulfate and the dextromethorphan includes dextromethorphan hydrobromide. That's the red brief citing to the specification at APPX 52 and 53. Similarly, the portion of the specification that my friend cited at APPX 59, columns 17 to 18, makes it clear that there is something distinguishing between what is administered and a corresponding calculated effective dosage. That portion of the specification states 30 milligrams of dextromethorphan hydrobromide and 30 milligrams quinidine sulfate may be administered, the word that's in the claims, and then pren, corresponding to an effective dosage. Those words do not appear in the claims of approximately 22 milligrams dextromethorphan and 25 milligrams quinidine. And then the last portion of the intrinsic evidence is the prosecution history. In an office action, the examiner characterized the then pending Claim 1. That claim appears at Appendix 955, and like the issued Claim 1, it uses the terms dextromethorphan and quinidine. On Appendix 973, the examiner explained that the claims cover the administration of dextromethorphan or dextromethorphan hydrobromide in combination with quinidine or quinidine sulfate. So the prosecution history actually supports Apelli's construction.
In the prosecution history, you're trying to distinguish Smith, which included at least a ratio of active ingredient of 1 to 0.75, right?
I don't believe Smith went down that low. It was using more than twice as much quinidine as dextromethorphan.
Well, that's what the examiner said.
But
both the Smith patent and this patent are concerned with the ratio of the active ingredients, right?
The Smith patent was a patent, an initial patent about the treatment of pseudobulbar effect that used maximally inhibiting amounts of quinidine, essentially enough quinidine to knock out all of the CYP2D6 in a patient's body. The invention here was that a something that was non-maximally inhibiting amount of quinidine, a very low amount in the range of 10 to 30 milligrams, which is what's claimed, would be sufficient to allow for therapeutic amounts of dextromethorphan. That's the context of the invention. The claims themselves, however, are focused on what is being administered to the patient. They are not about blood levels or about any other parameters.
So if we concluded that it's about the ratio is designed to achieve a certain blood level, then your construction would be wrong.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe the claim has anything to do with blood levels.
No. You're not answering my hypothetical. If we were to conclude that the claim is concerned with blood levels and that the ratio is designed to allow you to reduce the amount of quinidine in the blood, if that were the purpose, then your construction would be wrong, right?
That's not the claim, but I also don't think I agree. You have to look at the actual
amount.
Answer
my hypothetical, please. If that were the focus of the claim, your construction would be wrong.
Are you changing the amounts of dextromethorphan and quinidine in the claim as well?
If you were concerned with the amount in the blood, then your construction would be wrong, and you should focus only on the amount of the ratio of active ingredients, correct?
I know, Your Honor, I don't know what the difference in the blood levels would be, but the claims have amounts of dextromethorphan quinidine as well as the ratio.
You're not answering my question. My question is, if the purpose of the ratio is to affect the blood levels, if that's the purpose of the claim, then your construction is wrong because it takes account of something which doesn't affect the blood levels, that is the salt content.
If the ratio was what was, if you're saying the ratio is solely focused on blood levels, which it does not say, then I still don't believe our construction would be incorrect.
Well, there's going to be slightly different ratios.
Very slightly different, Your Honor.
If you have salt, as opposed to if you don't have salt.
If you do the math, you wind up with very slightly different ratios if you are calculating something and not using what's actually being administered.
Well, if you're administering with salt, you get one result of blood levels. If you administer it in freebase form, you get a slightly different level of blood level, right?
Are you talking about two separate products, Your Honor?
Yeah, sure. Two separate administrations.
Two separate products.
Two separate patients.
You could change two different salts, two different administrations.
Right. Okay.
You could change the amount of anything you want, Your Honor, right. And now you could create different ratios.
Question then would be how, taking a look at Smith, how close would you get if you did the math for the salt form of dextromethorphan? Orphan and quinidine, and versus the blood level in the case of, or versus the freebase one. How close would the salt, the two salts
the,
get
the, you? The difference between salts, if you're doing a calculation of an effective dosage from a salt, the differences are very small, Your Honor. I have not calculated them for anything in Smith. Though.
They may be very small, but under your salt calculation approach, it would come within the prior art in terms of the percentage of active ingredients, right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
No.
Not the amount.
1.75, I think that Judge Dyke is referring to.
Right. I believe that though, if the ratio, you also have to look at the amounts of the dextromethorphan and quinidine that are in claim one, not just the ratio. We would not get anywhere near Smith if you did the calculations based on the numbers there. But also, you have to look at the amounts that are actually in the claim, including the 10 to 30 milligram
quinidine. You wouldn't come close to the ratio in Smith that the examiner referred to.
You're not going to get close to the 1.1 to 0.5 if you were to.
The examiner said the ratio in Smith is 1 to 0.75. Or lower.
I do not believe that you would get anything close to the same ratio or have the same amounts of the dextromethorphan quinidine that are.
Well, you can do the math, but my math is that using the salt forms, you get pretty close to the prior art. It's at least almost 1 to 0.79.
I have not done any calculations based on Smith, but it does not meet the requirements of the claim. That's why why it was allowed during prosecution. There is no clear and unambiguous disavowal of the salts from the scope of dextromethorphan and quinidine in claim one, which is focused on administration, not effective dosage.
When the patent specification uses DM and Q, is it your understanding that those terms are used to include the salt form?
Absolutely.
Or to be exclusively the salt form and never refer to the freebase form, or to be agnostic between the two?
The patent uses dextromethorphan and quinidine sometimes to refer to salt and sometimes to refer to the freebase form.
And the shorthand DM and Q, would that be used sometimes to refer to one, sometimes the other, or would it be used consistently?
No, they are. That is actually our point. It's used both in a context dependent manner. That's why in claim one it is broad enough to include both. So, for example, in clinical,
when I say DM, I'm actually talking about the initials.
Letters. I agree with you, Your Honor.
Because that shows up at various points in the
Yes,
step.
Your Honor. When it's used, for example, to refer to a blood level of dextromethorphan, that will be the free base. When it's used in, for example, clinical study 3, which is on APPX 63, which talks about what's being administered, which again is what claim 1 covers.
Is the hydrobromide and the sulfate.
Exactly right, Your Honor. Yeah. So it can be used in a context dependent manner to mean either the free base form or the salt form. And that is explicitly our point. And for the focus, you know what you're using for claim 1 because the focus is on what is being administered. If you were to use the salt form, you calculate the ratio with what's administered, the salt form. If you were to use a different product, a hypothetical product that used the free base form, and that was what was administered, then you would calculate the ratio with the free base form. You do not do any type of math conversion of the salt form to the free base form when you go from the administration in the beginning of claim 1 to the ratio at the end of claim 1.
Okay, but in FDA labeling, it's common, is it not, with a product which is administered in salt form to be labeled according to the amount of active ingredient?
The product that's administered in the salt form,
it's labeled in terms of the amount of active ingredient.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that the case with your client's label?
The product uses the salt form, and that is specified as the active ingredient. That is the active ingredient, Your Honor.
No, but in your product, the way it's labeled in actual practice, it refers, when it says quinidine, it gives the amount of active ingredient, right?
What? Yes, Your Honor. The product uses dextromethorphan hydrobromide, and it's labeled in terms of the amount of dextromethorphan hydrobromide.
It seems to me that there may be a disconnect here. You're using the term active ingredient to include the salt. I think what Judge Dyke's question was, his premise, I think, is that active ingredient includes only the free base form of the two compounds. So given that question, does the label, your label, include the salt, or does it exclusively refer to the free base form of the two compounds?
In the weight. So when it says 20 milligrams dextromethorphan hydrobromide, that is the weight of dextromethorphan hydrobromide.
Of the salt.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which is what you're calling the active ingredient.
And the label refers to as the active ingredient. That is what's administered.
Well, I think we understand.
Is that in the appendix? Is that in the appendix?
The entire label is in the appendix. Your Honor, is that your question?
It might be helpful to point out.
Yes.
How the label is referring to the salt form.
Sure. If there's a question of the claim construction, which is not the label.
I just thought
form.
That we were talking about but, this, so it might be helpful.
Yes, you're right. That's the second half. Once you have a claim construction, then we go to infringement, and then to the infringement.
I'm not trying to. I understand. I'm just helping you answer a question.
No, thank you, Ron. The label appears, and this is Hetero's proposed label for Hetero's proposed product. It appears at Appendix 481. It spans a few pages, but it goes.
I was thinking about your label, but that's
okay. Okay, the differences between the labels are that Otsuka's label uses the brand name Nudexta, where Hetero's label uses the words dextromethorphan and quinidine instead of Nudexta. Otherwise, they are substantively the same.
Where this is at 481?
Yes. The description of the product is at 494. It should be the next page, Your Honor. The entire label does not appear. It's the front page and the portion that we were discussing, the description.
Okay, I think we're out of time. Yes, I have a question.
Thank you, Ryan.
Mr. Sandler, 2 minutes.
I want to start by addressing the comment that counsel made. He said, if Hetero put something in a different pill, it would be a different calculation. That means we can't really know what the claim is covered. Again, it goes back to the infringing product is how you determine a patent. That's not how you determine patent scope. And I want to go to your question, Judge Dyke. When a quinidine of 20 milligrams free base is put in the human body and a quinidine sulfate is put in a human body, quinidine sulfate has less will have less concentration of quinidine. In fact, quinidine sulfate has 83% quinidine. And so, yes, you're going to have a different ratio and different calculation when you're using salt versus free base. And in fact, this is not an eye exam, referring to APPX 644, Your Honors. If you can see, there's green and red at 644. The ones in green would be deemed, under the calculations, would be considered non-infringing. And if you do the and then the ones in red would be infringing. And so there is no way to determine the scope of the patent just simply the way that Otsuka is proposing to construe.
Their argument is that the patent's not concerned with blood levels.
Of course it is. That's exactly what it's saying. That's what it's trying to treat the neurological disorder. Yes, they're administering salt or anything. In fact, they're suggesting a whole slew of forms of administration. Each one has a different weight. Some have more, some have less. You're going to have your dextromethorphan is going to constantly change. And so the only way to determine and to treat the patient is to know what that level is in the blood by controlling what goes in dextromethorphan going into the blood, regardless of that salt form. And a claim construction that ignores that intent of the inventors cannot be correct.
But you know what the concentration is going to be. It's an easy calculation. The spec tells us how to calculate it. So if you want to put in a salt that has less dextromethorphan in it, and that's so be it. If you want to pump up the amount of dextromethorphan that goes into the body, you put a higher amount of the total salt. It's a pretty easy calculation, right? I mean, it's not as if you're fooling anybody and thinking how much dextromethorphan is going in.
We need to provide a specific range of therapeutic treatment to a patient to treat that patient from a particular neurological disorder. That means that patient needs a specific dextromethorphan amount in that blood.
Right.
Right? And
which
so,
you would know, depending on whether you're using a salt or a free-base form. You can easily determine what that amount is.
We can't, like because we can't do so when there's so many potential variables. You could be doing compound. Essentially, what they're suggesting is the claim can be construed as as dextromethorphan or its salt. And so with all these different variations, some of them may infringe and some of them may not. That goes to your point, Your Honor. And so yes, some of them may infringe and some of them may not, but that makes the claim indefinite.
If you can calculate with respect to any salt, any combination of these salts, exactly what the ratio is going to be, then you know whether for that particular treatment you infringe or not. That seems to me pretty straightforward.
But in doing so, because there are so many variables and the number of potential forms that can be used, there are no limits. And if we go back to Smith or any other references, you're looking at, again, no one had looked at it in the sense of, are we looking at it in the context of Smith, in the context of salt or compound? It was purely a compound-based comparison. The prosecution history completely confirms that interpretation, Your Honor, their construction is incorrect. In fact, if it is, if you do adopt their construction, it would render that claim indefinite. And so in that situation, we would not be infringing, Your Honor. Now, one last comment.
I think we're out of time. Thank you. Thank both counsel. The case is submitted.
Thank you.